There's an old story about a preacher visiting a church that wasn't his own church. And he asks, how long should I preach for? And the reply is, preach about 25 minutes and preach about God. Sounds quite good advice, doesn't it? However, if that preacher had to preach in the book of Esther, he might find a bit of a difficulty. Because the book of Esther is very strange. Maybe you know this. The word God, God is never mentioned in the entire book. How can you preach a sermon faithfully about God when he seems to be completely absent? It is a strange book in that sense. And you might wonder, why is this book in the Bible? Surely, the Bible's a book about God, isn't it? Why is he not there? Well, I think it's fair to assume that the Jewish writer of this has done that deliberately. He's thought very carefully about what he's written. You can see this in the whole structure of the book of Esther. And for some reason, he's deliberately chosen not to explicitly include God. As we look at this book for these next 3 weeks, keep that question in mind. What is the writer trying to say while not about God, while not writing about him? Let me give you a bit of background. These events, real events in history, take place in 483 BC. We know that because it's dated here at the beginning. That's about 100 years after all the Jews are taken from exile in Jerusalem and Judah, and they're taken to Babylon. They've been away from the home country for 100 years. A few of them have gone back, but many of them are still there. In terms of the rest of the Bible, all the events here take place just a bit before the events of Nehemiah. And so there's many Jewish people, many of God's people, living in a different country. And it's a multi-religious country. It's a pagan country. It's a culture that sometimes is hostile towards them, sometimes suspicious of them. There's a great deal of pressure to keep your faith, you know, quiet, hidden, to toe the line, adapt, fit in, forget the past, blend in with the culture around you. It's a culture where the true God, the living God of Israel, is officially absent. And yet, this is the thing you see as you read the story, and we'll look at it, actually where God is very much present. He's very much at work in the background, saving, acting. And I think as such, it's a story that speaks to us today. You know, we have a secular society, a society that really says, you know, actually God doesn't have an official place here. You know, we try to exclude God. In fact, you know, we put up laws which are sort of no trespassing signs. You know, no God here, no religion here. You can't talk about religion here. You can't, you know, we don't do God. But of course, the earth is God's. The Holy Spirit is everywhere. He's with us all the time. And you could say, God, the Holy Spirit, is a global trespasser. He's always ignoring those keep-out signs. You know, he's constantly at work in the world. You can't keep him out. And that's what we see in the book of Esther. You know, God, the Holy Spirit, is a global trespasser. He's always at work. In fact, he's not trespassing. It's his world. It's his land. So first, I want to look at what I'd say is described as the attractiveness of this king's power, the attractiveness of King Xerxes' power. Look there, verses 1 to 8. There's this glorious party described. Xerxes, he ruled the Persian Empire from 486 BC to 465 BC. It was a vast empire, stretched all the way from the Mediterranean to the borders of India. In the north, from Iran, the Caspian Sea, and Afghanistan, down to Egypt. You know, he ruled most of what we'd call the Middle East today. It's a huge area, perhaps covered by 15 different countries today. You know, at the time, it was probably the greatest, biggest empire the world had ever seen. Everything says, this is a mighty king. And in the third year of his reign, once he's got established, he holds a big banquet to display his glory. All the leaders, the generals, you know, all the nations he's conquered are there. And his purpose is probably twofold. Probably it's just simply to boast, what a great emperor I am. But then it enforces unity. All these people come and they think, he is so great, so powerful, so magnificent, I couldn't even think about rebelling against him. You know, it encourages loyalty, it squashes plotting. And everything about this empire is very big. It seems that there's two banquets. It's not quite clear from the text, but one seems to last 180 days. The gardens, the palaces are lavishly decorated. You know, money's been poured out like a river, like a flood on the furnishings. Everything is expensive. The wine is superabundant, the food too. You know, you can say it's kind of like Trump Tower on steroids. You know, it's like those people wandering around the Mediterranean in super yachts. There isn't just one super yacht, there's a fleet of super yachts there. That's what this party is like. And everything to the guest says, this is wonderful. You want to be part of this, fit in. Except, there's one little detail that's implied there at the beginning. It seems that military leaders and the nobles have a banquet lasting 180 days, verse 3. And then the rest of the city, all the ordinary people, they've got a slightly smaller banquet. It only lasts 7 days. Pagan and godly power can be seen to be made very, very attractive. It's seductive. Everything says, join in, join in. Isn't this wonderful? You know, we see the glamour and the glory of the world in front of us all the time. Programs like Love Island, it says, you know, physical beauty is this thing. It teaches you to idolize physical beauty. Way, fame and wealth. You know, you look at sporting events, at Wimbledon especially. Where does the camera focus? Well, it focuses on the court, then every now it zooms in on some celebrity sitting, you know, in the most expensive seats. It says, this is what you should aim at. There's the false aim of the footballers, the TV presenters, you know, these huge sums of money involved in major sporting events. Magazines, the internet devote just endless pages to them. It's all saying, follow me, follow me. Just in case we think, you know, the glamour, the glory of the world is out there and we can, you know, it's not us. You know, it probably just invades us in smaller, more local ways just as much. The new car, the fashions, the house makeover, the training shoes, the phone, the watch. The world has a great power to suck us in with its promises, false hopes. This will make you happy. You need this to be someone, it says. Underneath, it's all lies. It doesn't deliver. So the slogan of something like Britain's Got Talent, you know, this will completely change your life forever, is complete nonsense. It's ugly. You know, real beauty is not, you know, is absent. Real beauty is found in love, truth, kindness, honesty, sincerity, gentleness. You know, those things are ignored. And it's unfair. You know, the goods are only for some, and it's dangerous. They're powerfully attractive. But in the end, it's all lies. And that power is pervasive. It's everywhere all the time. It says to us, we need to watch out, be on our guard. This is what John in his first letter in chapter 2 writes. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes and the boasting of what he has and does comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever. And he's saying, look, it's there all the time, you know, in terms of boasting about what you do, boasting about what you have. But in the end, it leads nowhere. If that's your goal, if that's your God, in the end, you lose. You lose big time. And it's powerful. We need to be on our guard. As we go through the book of Esther, we just see how ugly and false all the apparent glory of the king actually is. That's the apparent glory of the king. And actually, as we go on through the story today, the story gets darker and darker. Look at the second half of the chapter from verse 9, and there we begin to see the abuse of the king's power. He has great power, but he's drunk. He's in such high spirits, he's had so much wine. He might control the whole of the known world, but he can't control himself. You know, and when he's drunk, you know, he shows what his heart is. You know, he's like the man who's drunk on the high street, you know, and is shouting his head off. And being drunk, he says foolish things. He wants to show his wife off. He doesn't care for his wife, but he wants to show her as a thing. You know, she looks sexy, bring her in. You know, she's not being treated as a person in her own right. Not surprisingly, in verse 12, Queen Vashti simply says, no, I will not be treated like that. You know, I am a person, I have more dignity than that. So here we have the world's greatest king, completely powerless, defeated by one word when his wife says no. There's a sense in which the Book of Esther is a bit of a comedy. You know, is his power and glory really so great? His wife says no, and he's completely stumped. He might rule nations, but at home, it's not quite so simple. It's not an international diplomatic crisis, is it, anyway? It's just a small domestic problem. You know, I mean, the Queen hasn't helped by being confrontational. She might have thought of a more tactful way to respond, perhaps. But only a fool, and I think the king is a very special sort of fool, you know, can turn this small problem into a major incident. And the delicate ego of this almighty king is so wounded, what does he do? He calls an emergency cabinet meeting, verse 13. That's effectively what it is. It's a meeting of COBRA, the Cabinet Emergency Committee. He calls in all his wisest advisers and says, what do we do about the queen? Poor man. So what should he do? Does he really need advisers to tell him what to do? No, he doesn't. You know, the truth about what we need to do when something goes wrong is often very simple. You know, he needs to humbly go to the queen, apologise and say, I was drunk, I was stupid, I was yobbish, I was disrespectful. I'm sorry I hurt you. However, I think his wisest advisers, you know, they're too wise to suggest something as simple as saying sorry. So they say, let's draft a law commanding all women to respect their husbands. You cannot command respect. You earn respect. You know, true respect comes from the heart. You can't change that by laws from the outside. The truth is very simple. Sin makes things complex. And so here's Xerxes. He's got great institutional power. He rules nations, but very little personal power. And when someone has very little personal power, sometimes they have to get their way by coercion, manipulation. You know, his leadership becomes a matter of, you know, my power, having my way, rather than really serving the people he rules over. That's Xerxes. He's a powerful man who's got his powerlessness really completely exposed. God's not mentioned in all this, is he? He seems to be absent, and yet he's very much present. Well, Bob, do you want to come and tell us what happens next in the story?